Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 13th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, the one and only, the inimitable Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. I know, I don't think you're lying when you say that, D.R. I'm sure you're doing very well. But tell me, I think there's a, no pun intended, hot topic, something on fire, you said it before, this week that I think we need to come to terms with. There's a magazine, which I, of course, don't read, but I get it on and see it online, called New York Magazine. It has a an article by a guy named David Wallace Wells. It's called The Uninhabitable Earth. And I will admit, just so that everyone knows, I haven't read the thing fully. I've got it in front of me. I've scanned parts of it. It is a horror story of the reality of what climate change will do to us, ranging from what I've seen. So let me just go through some of the chapter headings in this rather long article. One, I think, is the bar-raining of New York, right? There's poisoning the oceans. There's the end of food. Heat death. I guess it's quite possible that large fractions of the world will be higher than the wet bulb temperature at which people die, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. It is a quite depressing and horrifying kind of article, and it has drawn reaction and back and forth. So tell me, DR, did you see it? Tell me, what do you think of it? What should we go with in trying to come to terms with this article that has a lot of attached things with it?
I read the piece when it was posted Monday morning, and the two reactions were that, number one, the piece literally sums up Al Gore's line about a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. David Wallace Wells basically summarizes the what the Atlantic refers to as the quote absolute the bleakest possible scenario for global warming. The Atlantic writer notes that it does lay out, as you noted, Brooklyn possibly turning into Bahrain, essentially in terms of the heat. The breadbaskets of China and the United States will enter a debilitating and everlasting drought. And as written here, there'll be carbon-infused confusion due to the lack of oxygen. Now, my reaction also, before I saw any of the backlash and pushback from the story, was that this was the sort of story that, unfortunately and unintentionally, climate change deniers would love, because even though David Wallace Wells says that this is simply the potential worst case scenario, the theme and the tone of the piece clearly suggests that Mr. Wallace Wells thinks that this is absolutely going to happen, that we're not going to do anywhere near what needs to be done, and that therefore we're basically going to, you know, put the planet on broil. And the reason why climate scientists such as Michael Mann and others are objected to the piece, and why I think I agree with the objections, is that when you suggest that despair, when you suggest that we are essentially past the point of no return, past the tipping point, then the non-scientific mind, the average American, says, well, if we've already gone past the point of no return, why bother cutting emissions? Why bother doing anything to reduce my carbon footprint? You know, we're basically, you know, screwed anyway. You know, bend over and kiss your ass goodbye, as the old joke goes.
I was going to say Edgar Allan Poe's, I think it's The Mask of the Red Death, where they, you know, the yes. plague's outside. They are, okay, don't stop there. You really are down on the article. You think it's a bad move?
I mean, it's well written.
You're just saying that the tone and the impact is not what we want.
It's well written, but I think it is ultimately an unforced error. And I have to acknowledge here, because one of the things that really frosts my nerves about this piece is not the piece itself, but a supplemental piece that Mr. Wallace Wells posted shortly after it ran. He did an interview with a number of scientists about the piece and his research for the piece. One of the scientists he interviewed in this supplemental piece is a gentleman by the name of Wallace Broker. Now, if that name sounds familiar, Wallace Broker is the individual who in 1975 coined the phrase global warming. And as you read this interview, and we have to acknowledge it's stated as an edited interview, but still presumably Mr. Wallace Wells had some input in the editing. Mm-hmm. It's apparently never addressed in the piece. And I read it a couple of times and I didn't see where it was addressed in the piece. The controversy over the use of that phrase global warming, as we've discussed before, Keith Olbermann and Bill Maher have others have said that part of the reason why there has not been the public outcry and the amassing of political will to address this issue is because the very term global warming confuses people. People think of, non-scientific people think of the term global warming as being, hey, it's going to be summer all year. I can go out in a bikini and never have to worry about winter again. They don't associate it with fires and floods and death. Keith Olbermann famously arguing that the term for the consequences of the greenhouse effect should be weather disaster. And Bill Maher jokingly saying the term should be climatia. But in any event, this thing is never addressed. And also, the thing that I found infuriating, and I think it did taint my overall view of the piece looking back, is that Mr. Wallace Wells allows, with no apparent pushback, allows Mr. Broker to insult Jim Hansen. At one point in the supplemental piece, Mr. Broker refers to Jim Hansen's longstanding efforts to push for the carbon fee and dividend model to address greenhouse gas emissions as BS. And I found that highly, mm-hmm. highly offensive. Now, when Hansen himself criticizes people who support cap and trade, I push back against that and I say he's wrong on that. But to take all of what Hansen has done and all of Hansen's activism and dismiss it as BS is just grotesque, in my view.
You would not say that comes from some sort of denialist perspective. You would say that it's hopeless and it's BS because we're past the point of no return and that we're just talking to ourselves.
I don't see how it's productive. The tone of the overall piece is bad enough. The tone does inspire, and I agree with the criticism here, a sort of intellectual paralysis where you basically say, oh my God, there's nothing we can do. We are really screwed. We're not going to even think about trying to sort of turn this ship around. And that's bad enough. But when you start having people get up there and insult, mm-hmm. shamelessly and classlessly insult people, I mean, all the things Hansen has done for decades, all the crap he's had to put up with for decades, and for this guy who, again, came up with a phrase that delayed action, I think people like Olbermann and Maher are absolutely right. That uh-huh. phrase, delayed action. And for this guy who unintentionally caused the problem by coming up with the phrase that delayed action and confused the public to basically slap around Jim Hansen with his remarks is disgusting in my view. I'm sorry.
Wow. Well, okay. So, wait a minute. Let me play devil's advocate. All right. Okay. Because you clearly are. I can see where you're coming from, but it seems to me that part of the issue is that people just don't get it. People mm-hmm. don't understand the dire. I think this guy. I know what you're saying about his tone, but I mean, it seems like pointing out the reality that we could turn the planet into Mars. I mean, suppose mm-hmm. if we already have. My issue is not so much that somebody called it global warming in 1975, but that mm-hmm. the policymakers don't get this stuff and make the point that people should accept it. I go running every day. I went out the security shack and there's the guy sitting there and we're talking about the heat and whatnot. That guy doesn't get it. He's not mm-hmm. going to get it until the politicians and the culture starts to say this is important. And mm-hmm. I mean, talking about jobs, and economic growth is one thing. But on the other hand, the idea, the stark reality that we could turn the planet into Venus if we're not mm-hmm. careful, I mean, I think there's a role for that. I mean, a direct, you know, glass of ice water, if you can find any, right in the face to wake you up. There's the electric aftershave stuff, right? To sort of, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me there's a role for this. You don't want to depress people and put them in the disaster frame, right, where everyone gives up. Mm-hmm. So I take point.
Well, David Roberts, in his response to this, he made a point parallel to what you're making, that, you know, sometimes you have to hit people with the proverbial 2x4 in mm-hmm. the face to face the you know, to have people face history in themselves, so to speak, to face to the ultimate grim consequences of this. But my disagreement with what David Roberts argued in his piece is that we have to keep in mind not just the Chris Hayes argument about the asymmetry of intensity, but the asymmetry of media. When you put a piece like this out, it's only a matter of time before people like the Daily Caller and Breitbart and all those folks grab it and say, "See, look how alarmist and hysterical people are, these tree huggers are, and people who don't know science will fall for that." There's a whole lot. People have talked about how this has been spread like wildfire on social media. But ask yourself, how many of the people spreading this story are themselves deniers who are cherry picking the science in the story to say, "See, this is alarmist."
I got to push back though. The fact is, I mean, I read, now this is like 5 or 6 years ago, a scientific study where mm-hmm. they were, this object of the study was one person, but he was put in a classroom with a lot of Confederates, right? Other people that mm-hmm. were part of the studies. And they're all doing some sort of a test, right? You know, add numbers or do something. And all of a sudden, mm-hmm. smoke starts coming out of the ventilator, right? Mm-hmm. And the question is, how long is that one person going to sit there and not be the alarmist and not be Chicken Little while mm-hmm. all the other 19 people in the classroom sit still? I mean, there's mm-hmm. a role for alarm. I mean, there is. There should mm-hmm. be an alarm. We should be mm-hmm. screaming at the top of the lungs that terrible mm-hmm. things are going to happen. And the idea to say, "Well, you're going to call me, you know, a bad name and call me alarmist." Yeah, well, that's right. You want to go right up Breitbart's nose and say, "Yeah, this is real stuff."
But that goes to the objections of the piece, and there are a number of objections summarized in an article by Chris Moody in the Washington Monthly. And you know, if you want to raise alarm, it's one thing, but you can't erase. But it's a problem when you raise alarm in a potentially problematic way. Mr. Mooney quotes Bob Roop of Rutgers University saying, quote, "The article overall highlights important effects that have been discussed in the literature, but in a manner that is often sloppy and hyperbolic. It would have been helpful if the reporter identified his sources, which makes it difficult to check what he intended in some points," unquote. Mm-hmm. And Michael Mann objected in particular, according to Mr. Mooney, quote, to Wallace Wells' statement saying that satellite data showing the globe warming since 1998 more than twice as fast as scientists had thought, calling it erroneous. And Mann has pointed out that the satellite data shows that it's warming on the level of what it's scientists had thought, yeah. which is already severe enough, right, without having to basically overdo it in terms of the rhetorical drama, basically. Trying to make people woke is one thing, but sometimes you can try to make people woke and they'll go right back to sleep because of the tone in which you communicate science.
I think if you communicate despair, you're going to get despair, right?
Exactly.
And you don't want to do that. But I guess, I mean, when I, again, I you know, it's as I've read parts of this, but I mean, I know, and I've said on this show, that I'm tired of hearing about the latest bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef, or now I think it's today that, you know, the Larsen B ice shelf, ironically, has decided to set sail for Tierra del Fuego, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that depresses me so much that I want to talk about the solution, right? And that talking about the disasters, the seven, the biblical plagues, it's like, okay, I don't want to sit in that frame of mind. But does mm-hmm. that mean that I've already, in a, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out if I'm afraid of this stuff and don't mm-hmm. want to read about it because it's just so depressing. And maybe that's mm-hmm. making your point. I don't know. But I mean, I think, do you read voraciously each time there's this new terrible, terrible thing that's happening. I don't know, the Zika virus or the methane holes in Siberia. I mean, it just, I find after a while, it's like, okay, what am I going to do about it as opposed to how bad it's going to be? I mean, where do you go with that stuff? How do you manage it emotionally, I guess?
I always try to think of it in terms of the context of how we got to this point, how we got to the point where 29 years after Jim Hansen spoke to the Senate, we've had this sort of political sort of blockade. And I think about the individuals responsible for it. I don't think despair or the unintentional promotion of despair. Mm-hmm.
That's a nice way to put it. The unintentional promotion of despair, right? Is that a strategy?
Exactly. That's not the way to go here. What you want to do is to have people rage against the dying of the light, so to speak. And again, to say that this is what can be avoided. Yeah, and that's a lot of the social media criticism of the piece is that the piece doesn't really hammer away at the idea that there are things we can do and technologies we have at our grasp that can keep us far, far away from this bleak vision of what the future is.
That's a good point. And I think this article plays out everything on a business as usual. We don't do anything and you end up with the worst possible case, which is still the idea that we can still mitigate things. We may already have committed to a certain amount of warming, but that we can mitigate things is an important thing that has to be in parallel all the time, I guess, DR. Maybe you're convincing me.
We've often mentioned our friend Betsy Rosenberg and her, on her radio show, the theme song was, it laid out all the risks, but then it said, we can turn it around if we just come together. The chorus of the song wasn't, we're screwed. The chorus of the song was, we can turn it around if we just come together. But Wallace seemed to be implying that we're completely screwed.
Yes, and I certainly agree that the idea that, we're all, what's it? There was one of those airplane movies where the guy's running up and down the aisle of the airplane saying, we're all going to die kind of thing. That's not helpful. And so I would want to avoid that. I don't know. It's.
Although again, let me give the man credit. Let me give Wallace credit. The amount of debate this is stirred up in the press in just the past couple of days. I mean, I would say it almost rivals the amount of media coverage that Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement has gotten. I give him credit for sparking this sort of conversation and for creating, shall we say, some teachable moments. But again, you think about in the context. I was thinking about this in the context of contrasting Wallace Wells with Gore. Have you ever heard Gore say anything that could even approach despair? Have you ever, even in some of the most starkest science he's presented, has he ever suggested that it's a hopeless situation? Never. Because he knows that the moment you say it's a hopeless situation, or even imply without explicitly saying it's a hopeless situation, the bad guys win.
And I guess, so just to be technically accurate, I mean, the only thing that we can be hopeless about is the global warming commitment we have already made. Right, so there's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's not coming out anytime soon. So you got to manage to that, and then you can and the additional potential over the next decades, which is what you're talking about. That is where the hope lies, is to mitigate that as best you can. I'm taking notes to myself here. One other question though is, DR, who do you think the audience for this piece is? That is to say, not many people read New York Magazine. It's people in Omaha are not reading it. Now, the most average, it's like, who's going to pick up on this? It's going to be sophisticated, probably urban elites, for better or worse, that are already more or less bought into this, right? So is this just sort of disaster porn that you can say, oh my God, it's going to be terrible? Or is it aimed, or should, I guess what I'm thinking, where I'm heading is, this should be required reading for every public policy holder, public public office holder to say, this is what happens potentially if you don't get yourself together. And I think there's this symbiotic thing. It's like the intensity we talk about, the Chris Hayes asymmetry of intensity of political desire, right? The NRA wants it and the green people don't. But I mean, a lot of that, that's a feedback loop with the leadership that's pushing a message, which then gets diffused down to the guy, you know, who's sitting in the security shack at the place where I work, right? All of a sudden he starts to get it, and then it matters. I don't know. I asked you a question. Who's the audience for this thing?
Well, it's interesting. Literally, as you brought it up, it just popped into my head that this happens to be the fifth anniversary of that famous Bill McKibben piece, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, in the Rolling Stone, and how widespread the popularity of that piece was, and how that piece in many ways inspired the first People's Climate March. I think this piece is sort of in the vein of that, and I think that Wallace Wells's goal is to sort of, you know, influence the sort of debate about what we are willing to do. Remember, you know, even when Bernie Sanders was running for president, he was criticized because he mentioned climate change a lot, but there were people who argued that he really didn't put climate change into the main event of his political issues. So I definitely think that Wallace Wells is trying to say, you know, this is, you know, this really needs to be numero uno on the list of issues. Mm-hmm. You know, the argument that what Scott Pruitt is doing to the planet is far more dangerous than what Vladimir Putin is doing, that sort of thing. Whether he can achieve this goal remains to be seen, but I do think that was his ambition here.
Wow. Well, yeah, we got a interesting, if anybody, we'll put up a link, of course, to this article. It's in also some of the pushback. It is for people who follow the climate issue. It raises so many, a variety of issues. I mean, there's a lot going on in this thing, right? And we haven't even touched most of them, right? But the whole issue of how do you message? What does it mean? How do you communicate this stuff? Is it real? Is the science real? But, you know, do we all get in a circular firing squad and shoot each other over, you know, things? It's all there, and it's happening now. I think one of the interesting things I find about all these climate issues is that, you know, you realize that you're participating in this great public debate that is happening in real time, and you can weigh in, right? You can read it, you can have an opinion about it, and it's all there. So I would, if you're listening to this, I would urge you to read the article. Don't despair. What did you say, DR? The unintentional despair.
Promotion of despair.
Yeah, unintentional, you know? Promotion of despair. We don't want to do that, but you got to have open eyes.
You have to take the Bob Marley advice. You got to get up and stand up for your rights.
That's right. Okay. All right. Well, look, that's it.
And don't give up the fight.
Don't give up the fight. Anyway, we'll put up the link to this rather interesting article at the blog. It'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. And, of course, you can find us on Facebook at Mass Climate Action. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, yada, yada, yada. You know where they all are. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Happy reading. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.